Accession number 7325, reel 4.
Colonel Legg, reel 4.
Well, when I got to the battalion quarters of the Camerons, he'd just been hit by a shell, and all the people there were rather dazed. However, I went forward with Colonel Anderson to a viewpoint looking at down across the valley below Brigsby and Sanshaw, and I asked him where the forward companies were of the Camerons, and he said, "Oh, yes, they're up on the top features." And I then asked him which was the best route forward, because I didn't want to go to the wrong place. And he pointed out that the best route forward was a feature, a fold in the mountainside between these two mountains, that is, between Briggs Peak and Sanshaw. Now, it was quite clear to me that from what I've been told, that the Camerons were on the objective, and that I was moving forward in fairly safe conditions to merely to reinforce them if they were counterattacked. So I only had one officer then. The other two ones were commanded by sergeants. I got the officer who was commanding a platoon forward with me, and I gave him his orders, and I said, "Move your platoon forward into the valley below us." And I could point out a feature. And when you made that good, I'll move the rest of the company forward to you, and then we'll go forward together as a company, you see. Well, he then pushed forward, and of course, it took a bit of time, because the front edge of all those features had barbed wire, and you had to go through our own barbed wire before you could start going downhill into the valley, and then ultimately uphill onto the main objectives. Well, then when I'd given him sufficient time to get down there, I then collected the other two platoons commanded by sergeants, and I gave them their orders. And because there were no officers, I said I'd lead them forward. Well, as soon as we crossed the wire, came under very heavy fire from the enemy positions, and it became quite clear to me, almost at once, that the Camerons had not reached the objective, and that I was not going forward as a sort of general safe mood to reinforce them. I was, in fact, literally going straight into action from there. So I shouted to the two platoons to follow me and get as quickly as possible off the forward slopes and down to the base of the valley, because I thought, well, at least it'll be safer down there. Well, when we got into the valley, there was absolutely no sign of the platoon commanded by this officer. Of course, looking back afterwards, it's quite clear that what happened to him was what happened to me, that he'd been terribly shot up, and that he couldn't stay there, because when we were in the valley, we were under very heavy fire from the hills above us. We were completely exposed. So I said to my sergeant major, "Now you bring up the rear and don't let anybody straggle, and I will lead the two platoons of the remaining platoons of the company plus company headquarters forward till we can get some sort of safe position, when I can then decide what to do next." And I didn't say to him, but I knew that from Colonel Anderson that I should go up this feature, this sort of fold, between the two main enemy positions. But of course, what I didn't know is until I got into this fold, because the enemy was still on the high ground, that this was an absolute death trap. And eventually I got about three-quarters of the way up, and the only people remaining in my company were myself and eight men. Every single other one had been killed or wounded, except for that missing platoon. So there's not much I could do except take up a position behind a large rocky feature, which was safe, because we were being shot at all the time. And very shortly after that, a gunner officer arrived with his team for a forward observation. He was a forward observation officer. But To show the difficulties in those days, in order to be able to establish radio contact with the guns, he had to carry forward a radio. Instead of being just one bit of equipment on the back of one soldier, he had the best part of seven men carrying it. And by the time he reached me, one at least of those men had been hit. So he just lost one part of the radio. So he could do nothing. So there we were. It's one of these, people talk about war as if it's sort of, you know, it's easy. You get your orders and you either do or die. But of course it isn't like that. You get into positions when it's really quite hopeless. There was I with eight men, a gunner officer, and a few gunners who was out of communication with his guns. And there was nothing I could do except lie low there until such time as darkness came. Well, meantime, as soon as darkness did come, the gunner said, well, I'm not doing any good here. I'm going back. So he then disappeared back down through the valley and back into our own main positions in order, presumably, to get some more equipment, come forward again. However, sometime during the night, the missing platoon found us. So we were there, one platoon, plus about eight men. I should think, say, we'll call it one and a half platoons in round figures. We managed to sort ourselves out a bit. It wasn't very pleasant because the Italians, as soon as they could hear any movement on the hillside, and of course you couldn't hear much when the guns were firing, but when there was a lull, they used to use these grenades. I think they had some form of catapulting system. They used to catapult them down the hillside. So you were always getting these things dropping on you. They didn't actually really do any harm, but they made a terrible bang just as you were sort of thinking you were safe. And of course they would drop behind any sort of cover. So this was going on during the night. And towards the morning, a sergeant major from a Cameron's company came across the side of Briggs Peak, which is the left-hand feature, to where I was between the two features, and said that he'd had orders for us to join them, this company, which presumably must have been the reserve company of the Camerons, because it was only halfway up the ridge. So we did that eventually. Although during that night we did witness an attack going in, a British attack going in on Sandshore during the night, which I afterwards discovered was by my own regiment, that they'd been moved forward onto Sandshore, the right-hand feature, to carry out an attack there. I make that point because I really think that the plan was bad. They ought to have had two battalions, one battalion on each feature. They would have had enough troops, but without that, there simply weren't enough troops. Because if you're attacking uphill, when it's very precipitous, you really almost have to go up on hands and knees. You need to have a weight of troops. Otherwise, you get people completely isolated on a very broad front like that. Well, we then moved what was remains of A Company across the face of the mountain. Really across from probably about there to here.
Sort of down the slope from...
We were up quite high, keeping our same sort of level to where this other company was of the Camerons. I can't remember which company it was, and they, like us, they were terribly short of officers. They had a company commander and one other officer. But they did have a telephone through to... battalion headquarters, a line through, and during some time, the latter part of the night, they got orders that say that the two companies together were to combine and attack Briggs Peak, which at that time presumably hadn't been captured by anybody. And of course, like all these sort of orders, there was a certain amount of argument about who was going to command it, because I mean there was two company commanders and two companies, and after a certain amount of talk, I agreed that I would carry out the attack and they would support me. Well, then, as dawn broke, I don't know whether we were told this was going to happen, but to our horror, a whole regiment of Indian regiments started moving up towards up the side of Briggs Peak. I can't remember which regiment it was and from which brigade it came, but the direct effect of that was that it drew all the fire that the Italians could put on us, particularly mortar fire, because they could see these troops coming up in the early light. And of course they were all over us, and what we wanted was them to disperse and get somewhere else so that we could at least sort of carry out an attack on a broad front and not sort of just get to a place where we effectively were sort of standing room only. And with this mortar fire, of course, there was a steady wastage of casualties. And the first thing that happened, of course, the fire, and I imagine there was a certain amount of artillery fire as well, but I don't know, the fire cut the telephone link between us and battalion quarters. Well, there was such chaos then that I said to the other company commander of the Camerons that I would go to where that little signal section was, where the telephone had been, because they had I don't think they had a helio, but they had a lamp, one of these signals, flash lamps, on a tripod. And I would send a message back to the Camerons saying that there really needed to be some fresh orders, because there was no coordination whatever going on in this area, and there was no likelihood of us being able to carry out an attack, a coordinated attack, unless there was. So I went down to this place. Meantime, the company headquarters of the Camerons, which I'd really sort of moved in with, was in a sort of little cave almost on the hillside, with people spread about near it. But the actual place where the signal section was, with this lamp, was exposed. I went down there, and of course I'd hardly been there more than about 5 minutes, when the lamp was knocked out by a hit from a mortar. And I was hit with mortar splinters along one side. So I rolled over on my side, behind a rock, really to pull out my first field dressing, which is my pocket, and do something about this. And another mortar bomb arrived, and I've got another lot of mortar splinters into me. And so I was lying there, and eventually I got hold of one of the company stretcher bearers, which we, I think, only had about two. He hadn't got a stretcher by that time, but he was still alive and kicking. And I sent a message up to the Cameron headquarters saying that I'd been wounded and was going to be evacuated. And then I was taken by this chap down the hill, through the valley, and then eventually up the mountain the other side to Cameron Ridge, where the first field is, to the regimental aid post from there, and finally evacuated over quite a long period of time with an operation in the middle to a hospital near Khartoum.
How long did it take them to get you from the place where you'd been wounded down to where you could get some treatment?
I must have been wounded about fairly early in the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, and it must have taken 2 or 3 hours to get. I wasn't a stretcher case in the sense I could walk a bit, but I had blood and stuff and wounds down one's leg and in my neck and so on, and I was sort of being sort of pulled and manhandled by this very gallant stretcher bearer. It took me about 2 or 3 hours to get to my regimental aid post. He then patched me up as much as possible, which really meant putting on bigger bandages. They had a system quite near there that they got hold of these little sort of trolleys that the Italians had on this railway. You know, you sometimes see them on British railway when they work well on it. They're tiny. You can really push them by hand. They just have one big brake. And they used that for evacuating casualties. And I then went down on that sometime during the afternoon and arrived at some form of casualty clearing station, which was down in the valley. And I don't know how far, I can't remember how far that was. And they then gave me a shot of a few things there, and generally checked me over that nothing was going to go really wrong. And I then spent the night there, because I remember lying on the ground on a stretcher, my equipment, which I still had on me, was lying by my side. And when I woke up in the morning, some of my clothes had been partially eaten by white ants, and I was obviously so passed out that I didn't even know that was happening. Then that day, I was then put in an ambulance and taken all that day and most of the night by road to, I think, a place called Tassenai, which was a railhead. It's just inside Eritrea. It's a railhead. And that was the first place where they could actually had an operating theatre.
Can you recollect what you felt like on the instant that the mortar splinters hit you?
Well, I remember one terrific feeling of pain underneath my ribs here. And I rolled over and pulled up my shirt, thinking that I was terribly badly wounded. And all that had happened was obviously a bit of a rock had flown up from the ground as a result of the first or second mortar bombs that had gone off near me. And it hit me, and it merely left a huge, great wheel or bruise, as if I'd been hit under the ribs with a very heavy stick. Otherwise, the actual wounds, I remember feeling I was being wounded, because it happened twice, and I felt, well, if it happens again, that'll be the last. But it wasn't until a few hours later that it really began to hurt, and everything swelled up. My thigh went up into a sort of balloon, because you get a tremendous bruising with wounds, and one's leg went absolutely stiff. And my neck was in a terrible state because, though one didn't know at the time, all one's nerves pass through one's neck from one sort of brain to the rest of one's body. And if you've got something wrong with your neck, you can't do anything, even if you sort of raise one little finger, without it somehow making your neck feel it. It was very unpleasant there.
So the actual pain at first came more from the rock fragment than from the
that was the main. The other thing was merely a sort of a minor feeling of pain, and a slight feeling of shock, of course, I think.
Can you describe what it felt like to be evacuated from the battle area whilst you were wounded?
Well, the feeling I felt when I got to the regimental aid post and behind it was a feeling of absolute relief. I mean, we practically broke down after the tension of what had been a very unpleasant 24 hours. You suddenly felt, I'm out of it. Although it was very far forward, all this, and they were probably being shelled themselves, you felt it was sort of completely peaceful there.
Was it very painful to move once you'd been wounded?
Only later, when it within an hour or two, it became extremely painful to move.
Going back to something you said earlier, when you were describing about going along the fold,
yes,
and you had all those casualties,
yes,
was there anything that could have been done about those casualties?
No, you see, this was the trouble. You didn't know where they were, where they'd fallen. There was no sort of backup to find out what had happened to them. One of the worst things about that particular campaign, as far as I was concerned, is that by the time I got out of hospital, which was quite a long time after that, the battalion had not only left that area, but it was fighting in Syria against the French, and had already been completely reorganized and reinforced, and had already suffered further casualties. So that it was never possible to put together exactly what happened to everybody. To this day, I just don't know how many people were killed or wounded in that company. All I do know is that the great majority of them must have been wounded anyway.
What were they throwing at you whilst you were progressing up the fold?
Well, they were it was mostly small arms, because you see, we were well within rifle machine gun distance. There was a certain amount of mortar fire, and I think a certain amount of shell fire, but we rarely went into an area which was raked by small arms fire, and without really knowing it. I'm not blaming the CEO of the Camerons, because he didn't know that either. But in fact, he sent us into a death trap. If we'd gone up the main slopes of one or other of the features, there must have been a little bit of dead ground. But you see, there are the two features. If they're slightly turned inwards, and there's a sort of fold or rift, anybody on either top can look into this and fire down into that. And that's what happened.
They were firing into a completely concave area.
Yes. Because you never knew when one was safe, because I remember particularly going up that area, and we really were doing it at the double, although it was extremely tedious. I remember pausing for one moment to try and sort of get people to come up, follow me. And almost at once, a bullet landed literally between my legs. I mean, you could tell that there was a splash of dust. And then one realized one was being observed all the time, from one side or the other, particularly from Sanshaw. From our right, on our right, they were looking right across onto us.
Going back to something you said earlier, you were talking about the tremendous noise of the battle.
Yes.
What were the physical effects of that noise, physical and nervous effects?
Oh, I think it has a very considerable nervous effect on you. It wears you down, noise, all the time. You begin to feel... Why can't this stop? Why can't we just sort of have a little bit of peace for a moment? But it takes a tremendous amount of getting used to that.
But did it make people bad-tempered and shouting at each other?
I don't think they got bad-tempered. I think that they certainly got edgy. I mean, it's very frightening. I mean, it's rather like being in the worst thunderstorm you've ever known. And you know whether it was a thunderstorm. The sound is coming and going. You don't know whether the next flash is going to be over your head or it's going to be a mile or two away. And then you think, oh, well, it's gone. Then suddenly there's this appalling bang over what you think is over your head. Even though it probably is quite a long way away, you don't know that. And particularly at night, it's very soul-destroying.
Were there any physical effects, such as the effect on eardrums?
Not that I know of, no. Not with us.
You mentioned the railway being used to evacuate casualties.
Yes.
Was the railway used for any other purpose?
It hadn't, as far as I know, ever been used before to bring up rations or anything like that. But there obviously had been a plan to put a little bit of rolling stock on it and either bring up, presumably they used that for bringing up supplies during the final battle, and then to evacuate the empty carriers, so to speak, the empty trucks on the railway were used to evacuate casualties. As far as I know, certainly on the Cameron Ridge sector of the railway, it was never used while we were in normal defence.
Coming back to your convalescence, what was the quality of medical treatment that you got?
Oh, I think very good. The position was that they got us back to this, I think it was a main casualty clearing station. I won't call it a hospital. And those that needed operations had them done just like that. Then you were given one night to recover. And then you were put on a hospital train, which was obviously going to and fro from there into Khartoum and then back again and so on, day after day. So I had an operation at this place, I think it was Tessenai, and then 24 hours later I was in Khartoum, and then in a in a proper general hospital then. And I think, bearing in mind that the fact that they had to use buildings which are not originally designed for hospitals, I think they made a very good show of it. And I have nothing but praise, really, for the RAMC. I think they did very well indeed.
Did they have sufficient drugs?
Yes, but of course, yes, I'm sure they didn't lack for drugs as they existed at that time. It was before the days of penicillin, but they were using the sulfonamide drugs then, so you had to take those all the time. So that there was, in other words, a considerable leap forward from the old days of the risk of gangrene and septicemia. I mean, I remember people getting gangrene in the hospital and dying, but I don't remember more than like one or two cases of it. So that was another blessing which we were lucky to have.
Is there any summary you'd like to give of the campaign?
Yes. I think the first thing to remember is that the Eritrean campaign was one of the very early ones in the Middle East. And the result of that was that, first of all, the infantry had very simple equipment. And that had certain advantages, certain disadvantages. The second thing was that it meant that practically no one taking part in the campaign had had operational experience, except those who had fought at the Battle of Sidi Barrani. And that particularly applied to the commanders. Most of them hadn't had operational experience, and I think as a result of that, they weren't all that good. There was always a tendency to assume that the Italians would run away in the end, however strong they were and however weak we were. Now, this resulted in risks being taken and unnecessary casualties. The other point I'd like to make about Eritrea is that it is a very unpleasant country, very barren, very rocky, very hot, and there's no shade. And we had absolutely no welfare whatever as far as the troops were concerned. So far as I can remember, there was no NAFI at all in Eritrea throughout the whole campaign, but there may have been after I'd been wounded. The rations were very poor, and of course there was nothing else. And I can remember an occasion when my entire regiment ran out of razor blades, and we had to send a truck the whole way from Eritrea back to Khartoum to buy soap and razor blades and toothpaste and other necessities of life. Now, when you compare that with the sort of things that went on later on in the war, it's unbelievable. The other thing I remember particularly was that it was a war of constant movement, and really one lost all sense of time. One of the ways we used to know that time had passed was that each company had a radio, which I think had been probably presented. It was a welfare radio, not a military one, presented by some organization, the Indian government or British government or something, which ran off a car battery. And when we were out of the line, or when there was a moment in the evenings when we weren't doing anything, we used to switch this on and try and get the news. And at that time of the war, there was a well-known series on radio called High Gang, with a chap called Vic Oliver and B.B. Daniels and Ben Lahn. And I remember distinctly listening to that one night, and then almost immediately another night hearing it again. And I realized that a week had gone by. Otherwise, one got lost all sense of time.